Who says tech can't be human?
What is going on, Hacker Valley fam? Welcome back to the show. I am super excited to be coming to you live. This is a completely live show. I'm joining from Austin, Texas. And to kick it all off, we've brought in a very special guest from a very special company. With me, I have Neil Humphrey, who is the VP of Marketing Strategy at DeepWatch. DeepWatch was grateful enough to sponsor this live show. And we're also going to be talking about hyperautomation, open security data architecture, and the future of the SIEM. But most importantly, Neil, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it, bro.
Yes, appreciate you for joining. Appreciate you for being here. And also, thanks to our sponsor and partner, DeepWatch. You know, they're putting on the stream with us. By checking out our partners, it's the best way to support the show and to level up your security operations practice. So, Neil, let's jump in to learn more about you first and foremost. Give us a quick 1 minute summary of your background in cybersecurity.
Yeah, sure. So the beard holes meeting, I've been in this for a while, about 20 years or so, maybe closer to 25, right? You know, every year's 7 years in dog years for security concepts. But really kind of started from, and this will become important in kind of how we look at things or view things. I've always been on the product side of the house, and actually started in functional load testing, performance testing, kind of kernel level debug stuff, going back to the early 2000s. And so it was early in data ETL, code development, early automated code run stuff, and then ran over into security, really, kind of naturally dropped me into that. Going on 15 years or so ago now, maybe actually longer. But been at it for a while, seen lots of things, been in lots of buildings, talked to lots of people.
I feel you. I feel like I've seen a lot. I haven't seen everything, you know, but I feel like I've seen a lot though. And one thing that I've seen, and we've all seen it because it's affected us all, is digital transformation. And my favorite thing about it is the fact that we get to work remote. It feels like it's been ages since I've worked in an office. I don't even remember what it was like. And, you know, if we think back to 2019, things were different, especially when you look at security operations and how we operated as a team or even as a SOC. When you look back at the year 2019, what was security operations like back then?
I don't know if security operations, so you almost have to separate that question between what was the physical nature of security operations and then what was the procedural nature is probably the best way of putting it, of security operations. So from a 2019 to current perspective, from a procedural level, I don't know if it's changed tremendously. It's sped up from that digital transformation of moving from on-prem assets to cloud-based assets or additional tooling, or, you know, we'll talk a lot more about automation and other pieces later as kind of, you know, adding gas to that fire. But physically, I really think it's changed a ton. You know, again, being in this as long as I have, I've been in hundreds of security operation centers. And we always had that physical SOC wall. We had the really nice one had, you know, you hit the light turning on when you logged in, and I'm in yellow is IR and blue was a firewall and red was IDS, IPS or whatever it may be, to kind of designate which desk you were at. A lot of that is coming back, but I think it's changed irrevocably. Like it's just gone now. We see a lot more, and we've all gotten better at mobile work, mobile communication and collaboration, being able to. The other thing that's also, I think, changed physically and did impact a little bit of the procedural nature of SOC since 2019 is SOCs have always worked around or needed to take into account context. You know, what's happening within the organization, what happened yesterday, what happens tonight, freeze aspects, updates, those sorts of things. not being in the same location, not being in the same building, hasn't reduced the need for those things. But it has made that collaboration and coordination different. It's not better. It's not worse, but we have to look at new tooling. We have to look at new ways of communicating and staying in sync. I think that's another change that's actually happened.
I miss that sock wall. I remember, you know, when I worked as a threat hunter, we had a little sock team and we had a sock wall, and it felt like, you know, this was our way to flex as a security team. And, you know, now we don't have that. Well, and we might, maybe part of your SOC is still in person and you have a SOC wall, but what is the modern SOC wall today?
That is an absolute great question. And I'll hit that one on two different sides. I don't think there is a modern SOC wall, to be honest. I think there is a singular interface or a collection of interfaces that a SOC analyst is going to be working through today. Like we, again, I've been on the product side for a very, very long time. I came over to DeepWatch about 4.5 years ago, which is a bit of a combination of product plus being responsible and a partner for our customers and making sure that things work appropriately. I say that to be able to say that the number of times I've told customers that if somebody tells you they have an actual singular pane of glass as part of their sales pitch, they're lying to you. Like, that doesn't exist. It's not going to happen. Like, that's just not there. So that's, you know, we're looking at a collection of interfaces now, and hopefully we're dropping that down to a more manageable 2 or 3 tab style concept within a browser. But if you look at your, you know, depending upon the size of your sock, your old sock wall could have been 7, 8, 9, 10 different screens that were up there. And from a product perspective, I need to call out a bit that even for internally at the Security Operations Center or externally from a vendor standpoint, that SOC wall was more important than we think about, just because of daily ops. It was a view of value. It was from a vendor perspective. I always knew if I could get my interface on the wall, then it was valuable. People could see it. They knew that it was there, and that people were utilizing the tool, which is a different conversation for security. And from an internal politics perspective, if I knew that I was looking at budget or I was dealing with other managerial or even internal politic perspectives, I'm going to make sure that thing that I know that I want to maintain is up on the wall. And I'm inviting the executives, I'm inviting the CIO, I'm inviting the whoever else needs to be included in this down to the SOC to take a tour and making sure I'm pointing those things out. So the lack of the SOC wall has really, in my opinion, impacted how tools are valued, how security shows its value, even internally and externally moving forward. And that's going to have ripple effects over time.
Yeah, I bet. And, you know, you were talking a lot about not having a single pane of glass. And I think one can wish, right? You know, we all wish that we did. And maybe that leads to a little bit of that burnout that we hear about a lot when it comes to security operations teams. From, you know, DeepWatch is one of the leaders in the space. When I worked in the SOAR space, a lot of my customers use DeepWatch to help manage their security operations practice. What is, you know, the thing that security analysts are feeling today? You know, this was back in 2019, 2020 when I was doing this and working with DeepWatch. But, you know, what about today? Are they still feeling that same level of burnout because of context switching and things like that?
I actually had a great conversation with a prospect earlier on this week who really kind of defined it the best that I've heard in a while. And the definition was, we're not planning on how to stop burnout from happening. We're not looking at introducing or measures or reducing the risk of this thing occurring. It's an accepted. Like, we just where security operations is today, analysts are going to be burnt out, in their opinion. And so they are looking more at what are some of the strategies, what are some of the procedures or things that they can put in place to manage burnout. Just to try to keep people engaged, to keep their analysts moving forward. Ultimately, the reasoning for burnout is the same in burnout in anything. You're bouncing from item to item. You're playing alert to threat-based whack-a-mole, and you're just don't have enough time to spend on the items or the things that pop up. I'm reminded, or I think about anyone who's ever done any call center work in their life, like that ding every 30 seconds when another phone call comes in type of scenario. It's the same thing. I'm just glad we don't have the audio click in security alerts, because it's, oh, look, there's another one, and look, there's another one, and look, there's another one. And that's the thing about security that we all frankly love, right? It constantly changes. It constantly evolves. It's always moving around. It's that tiger you're always trying to catch and hold on by the tail. So that we know that it's never going to stop.
Right.
And so that's the management of this, that we have to figure out time. We have to figure out focus. And we have to figure out also career path and allowing people, it sounds trite, but the chance to breathe and assess.
For sure. I think that's where things like hyperautomation comes into play. And, you know, that's one of the topics that this live stream is all about. But we're also be talking about open security data architecture and the future of SIEM. But I think it would only be right to start with hyperautomation. Maybe that's one of the things that could alleviate some of that pressure first. This is a new term. You know, when I was practicing as a security architect, it was all about SOAR in my heart. But it sounds like hyperautomation might be the future of SOAR. So how would you describe hyperautomation to someone that hasn't heard that that term yet?
Yeah, I mean, think of hyperautomation is the next step in SOAR. It's the next term in SOAR. And we're pulling it from a technical partner that we utilize and that we have. But it really is a good term for us to kind of step behind and utilize. When we look back at security automation, and I'll throw this in a bit. For me, everything it's interesting because where I started from in testing tools and in functional testing, load testing, ETL tools, automated data, automated code generation and verification stuff. Everything's cyclical. And so the same thing that we saw automated code and automation starting up in the dev side or test side of the world rolled over into DevSecOps, and now it's rolled over right into security operations. So we've seen some examples or histories of this in the past. And I bring that up because we saw SOAR and we quickly embraced it. It's a great technology. It's a necessary technology. Obviously, again, it's a continuation of successful trends. But it had the same problems. It had the same teething exercises that the other ones did around, hey, this is code. You have to live with it. These are logic components that have to be put in place and not just created once, but kind of constantly tested and verified. This is an ongoing engineering effort that usually is written in Python. Right. Or, you know, even if it's not written in Python and it's more of a drag and drop interface, the backend's still in a computational language. So you've got to keep a hold of all of those things. What hyperautomation has done is kind of pulled a lot of that out. It's not focusing on, it still has to do those things, but think of it more as a bit of SOAR as a service style activity. Is the term that we would want to use, and being able to focus more on, especially from an analyst perspective, from a SOC manager perspective, from a threat hunter perspective, being able to look at the questions that need to be asked, the answers that you expect, and then what your logic tree, or to use a bad analogy, the choose your own adventure item that may come out of that, instead of worrying about, well, did I update those API keys, or, yep, you know, I got to rewrite that regex because that term's different now, or they're using a semicolon instead of a colon spacer. Like that's the weight and the engineering that goes along with all these tools. Hyperautomation is just kind of taking that out.
Powerful. I like that. That was part of the bane of my existence on the security orchestration, automation and response side, the SOAR side, because a lot of the times when I was building playbooks for organizations, it was data normalization. That was probably the biggest piece. Like, we would have to connect to an API and then figure out a data model that we're going to put the information that's collected. And to me, when we first spoke about OSDA, Open Security Data Architecture, it kind of sounded like it's bringing order to all of the chaos of normalizing data. Is that the case?
That is 100% the case. Again, kind of my bent's a bit historical in mindset, and it sounds frankly hyperbolic to put it like this, but you look back on what are some of the major moves in human history and human technology, and frankly, it's like the one of the major ones is the advent of replaceable parts, right? That's how you got an assembly line. That's how we started moving things forward. And I think where we're at now in automation, where we're at now in cloud environments, the interconnectedness of to go way back 10 years, the Internet of Things, right, type of concept. I do think we're starting to hit on some real data standards that are being applicable across the entire market or across the entire segment. And hyper automation is one of the things that's now being utilized to either normalize as part of your back-end infrastructure, or it's utilizing a known standard that may have been accepted by multiple major vendors or multiple major providers that allows us then to focus in on the logic. And we are still doing error handling within code and other activities, but that level of effort is much lower now in hyper-automation. And OSDA is picking up off of that to say, frankly, if I have a data standard, I'm kind of starting to remove some of the needs for the advent of a SIEM or a data aggregator on the front end. And maybe I can reduce my focus on that and utilize more native standards, more native requirements for data or for automation or orchestration purposes that I can take advantage of and be able to get more bang out of my security buck, maybe the best way of putting it.
I have to jump in for a second to share some details about our sponsor for this episode, DeepWatch. Today's security programs and security operations centers are suffering. Just ask them and they'll tell you. But in all seriousness, we know the classic problems that they're experiencing daily. An overabundance of low-quality alerts, a distinct lack of time in managing burnout. Not preventing it, but managing it. The business world has embraced the adoption of cybersecurity, and the cybersecurity industry has matured. A newer problem has started to arise. The business world is starting to push back. Gone are the days of increasing budgets just because. Not only that, our budgets are under greater scrutiny, and the ability to maximize existing capabilities is becoming more and more important. This is where a company like DeepWatch comes in. DeepWatch is the managed security platform for cyber resilient enterprises. DeepWatch is interested in partnering with their customers to advance their security programs, not just reduce alerts or decrease the rate of false positives. DeepWatch has a focused team of experts that operate as an extension of your team. They provide continuous monitoring, advanced detections, rapid response to threats, and most importantly, the partnership and guidance that a security program needs to advance. DeepWatch has made it their mission to enhance your security posture and grant you an unparalleled peace of mind. You can learn more by visiting deepwatch.com and tell them Hacker Valley sent you. Checking out DeepWatch is the best way to build a more cyber resilient security program while supporting the podcast. Thank you, DeepWatch, for sponsoring this episode. I'm sure that anyone here that is practicing cybersecurity from like a technical perspective has been in a SIEM. And once you put your information and your data into a SIEM, if you're that person, that analyst, that researcher, engineer, you're going to have to know the language of what to type in, the syntax. Like, all right, is it IP address or is it IP underscore address or is it IP ADDR? And then, it was very expensive to manage a SIEM, mainly because of the data that you had to store. And then also getting an architect that would build a data model or train your team to use a data model. Who's behind this OSDA concept? Is it DeepWatch?
It is us that's kind of leading the charge on setting the expectations for this. Like, this is an active project that we're developing And we're the ones to do it is probably the best way of putting it out there. Again, that sounds prideful or arrogant, but in order to put something like this,
order.
Well, it is, but in order to do it and to do it right, you have to be, I don't want to use the word agnostic, but I'm going to be forced to. You have to be looking at different tools and seeing what works and what doesn't work. And you don't want to have ownership of a particular tool. To use your example, right? Let's say that I'm a major vendor of security tools. I'm pushing my own platform. Then I have my naming standard. Like I've forced my tools to use IP_address to back that out. Like, okay, if we look at targeting within security operations, and I'm looking at, say, an endpoint, a Windows machine. Well, how am I identifying that Windows machine? Is it by IP address? Is it by host name? Is it by MAC address? Do they have multiple IP addresses? Is it an agent ID? Is it a UUID from another set of capabilities? Like there are multiple different ways of identifying something at a point in time. And so being the ones that can kind of step out of that and to say, hey, let's standardize this. We're going to help you from a hyper automation perspective or from an outside industry standard perspective. This is what we want to utilize. And it can be therefore across multiple toolings, multiple platforms, to really start to shrink this down so that when say we look into the future and what we're seeing, even today on some of the more NLP or neural language programming type pieces of, I can just ask it a question and it's going to know that these are the three or four things to go look for, to go see, do I have an entry here? Do I have an entry here? Oh, nope, I got that entry there. That then leads me down another reference path to answer the question that was originally asked. That type of standardization, but yet flexibility and being able to know what works and what doesn't work, is why DeepWatch has to be the one to do this. It's not going to come from a monolithic vendor because they're not looking at other tools. They're going to enforce their standards and not be aware of, well, they like to call it this, or they've got a slightly different flavor on how they would, to go back to separators. They're a comma separated company and the other one's a semicolon separated company, or they're a YAML versus a JSON perspective, right? These are things that only a provider who is working directly with customers who can see what actually works in the field is the ones that can do this.
Right. You mentioned not being a monolithic provider, not being like a vendor, more or less. So maybe there's someone on the stream right now that hasn't heard of DeepWatch yet. How would you describe what DeepWatch does?
We are a cybersecurity partner for helping our customers build and improve their security programs is the way that I would really try to talk about us. We are absolutely in the managed detection and response space. We work with for example, SIEMs, and have gotten really good at understanding, like you mentioned, Ron, like you can set up a SIEM with a data engineer or a data engineer or a SIEM architect, whatever turn of phrase you want to apply to that role. And they set things up and everything works great. And that's wonderful. And then, because of the way the market works, they're off to go do something else. And then how does that system maintain itself? And the same thing we were talking about with automation applies for SOARs and applies for SIEMs and applies for any of your technologies. So DeepWatch is the company that can help you from a manage and a monitor perspective, looking at managed detection and response, looking at the other components of what we would call your cyber resiliency, on being able to say, hey, we're including what's going on from a protocol perspective, and not protocol and like we would think about technically, but how are you responding to these things? How are you identifying your risks, your exposures? Let's talk to you about your internal response plans and what are you doing with these items? Again, it's a program partnership versus a tool that you install and it you turn a crank and a light goes off and then a siren happens and then a Pez dispenser pops out the backside. That's not necessarily what we're doing.
Yeah. I could understand why it would be much better for an organization like DeepWatch to create this standard than a vendor. Cause during my time as a SOAR provider, Some vendors didn't want to give us access to their APIs. We would have to, you know, just about beg and say, hey, we haven't gotten access yet. We haven't gotten access. Can we please help enable both of our customers? But, you know, DeepWatch is right in the middle. Like you said, you're an extension of the security teams that you all work with. And when I was working in the automation space, there was always a chicken and an egg question. Should I do my automation first and just like build out these automations? Or should I really take the time to build a data model first? So if you were to look at hyper automation on one side and OSDA on the other, which one would you prioritize if, you know, you're kind of like building that SOC after, you know, the manual processes are understood?
For the record, that is an evil question. I'd like to combine both answers into one chicken and egg, is probably the best way of putting it. And I have to answer it that way because everything's in, we're all in a state of flux, right? I mean, things have already been built. We have outcomes that we are really pushing for that we need to provide. Not a, and we, you know, kind of DeepWatch's opinion going along with being a program and a partnership, again, that cybersecurity partner, is about pushing towards the outcome, right? Not pushing towards the implementation of a tool. We want to make sure you get what you paid for out of it. So I say that to say that part of the, we have a need for automation to give us time, right? We know we have questions that need to be answered so that an analyst can look at something that's coming in and then evaluate based on a series of responses or information that's already there to make a faster, better, more accurate decision. So we have part of that has to be done because one, that's what we're expected to do. And two, I have to make sure I meet that time frame or that outcome to get that piece done. But you have that necessity at the same time that we do have changing data models. I do have changing tooling that's going on. I do have, I'm moving from, you mentioned data, digital transformation. You know, I'm moving from an on-prem environment or I'm taking an existing ERP solution and moving it to a SaaS provider or I'm moving to a cloud environment. I'm establishing a new landing zone type of thing. Those are new data sets. Those are new data models. These are new things that need to be brought in. So it's the way that we would like to describe it, at least, well, let me say we. Not speaking of my personal opinion, not necessarily DeepWatch's in this matter, it is a matter of handling what you can handle now. So lots of folks right now are looking at, hey, security environment has always been kind of knee jerk. I'm going to kick this tool out and bring this other tool in type scenario. And there's validity to that. We would argue that we should look at more of an organized move, maybe an organized migration rather than an exodus type of scenario. So let's focus in on what we can do today automation-wise, what seems to be working. And that's another point of OSDA is that understanding of what works versus doesn't work. And I assume we'll get into that in a second. But focus on that. And then what do you need to expand beyond that piece? So if automation's working great, focus in there. If your data model or your data sets are working great, focus in there and then try to improve your automation. But think about not just where you're at today, but you know, where do you think your steps are going to take you in 6 months? Where are you going to go in a year and a half? Try to save some time to start thinking a little bit more strategically so that you can plan that organized migration, not that, I got to leave my dorm room tomorrow.
And it can seem like, you know, maybe you'd want to go about it alone because budgets aren't as large as you hope they were, or you don't want to make that bit large of an investment towards a tool or a piece of technology. But I think that it's very wise, especially if protection is important and, you know, there's going to be severe consequence, because like the average cost of a breach today, it's over $1 million for an organization, you know, assuming that they have like sensitive information or they have PCI standards that they have to follow. $1 million for not making that investment. And every great player, I got a great one behind me, the late, great Kobe Bryant. Every player has great mentors. They got a coach. They got a partner. They got a team. They have technology. You really need it all. And I love what you're saying about just don't go at it alone. Like even if it's a mentor is going to help guide you. If it's an advisor, if you have an advisory board, you know, maybe put somebody on the security side on that advisory board. CISOs are begging for a seat at the table. So I think, you know, them bringing in this level of information, asking those right questions. I know that you said that you guys helped them ask the right questions to their technology, to their team. If they wanted to go about that, and, you know, you're working with an organization, let's say it's a, you know, I brought up PCI, let's say it's a financial institution. What kind of questions are you going to ask their team or their technologies?
Well, I mean, that's another webinar or another webcast, frankly, off of that, right? But I'll roll it back to the very beginning of what we started talking about. You know, the CISO wants a seat at the board, and rightfully so, right? Now their CISOs are being called to account more so than ever. But what are you going to say to the board? Like, what are the metrics or the values or the things that you're going to be talking about to show the state and health of your security program? Again, used to, it was you bring them on a tour of the SOC wall and look at all the great stuff we're doing. And here's all the things that we've blocked. And this is, you know, here's your pew-pew map of things that are going on. Isn't it pretty? And let's move along. Like, that's not really effective anymore. You know, we've seen a lot of security's grown up is probably the best way of putting it. As much as some of us may wish that it hadn't around different angles or avenues. But we have to be able to talk in a business sense moving forward. Like, what's the budget considerations for this one? Can I show that this tool that I want to acquire or this headcount that I need to go get is going to impact the ongoing business capabilities or the business risk of the organization itself? Can I put a numeric value associated to those? And ultimately, what are the questions that need to be answered to show, I'm going to beat on this term again, the forward progress of the security program? At DeepWatch, we talk a lot about the idea of cyber resilience beyond just simply saying, hey, we're doing managed detection and response. Because the thing that we've learned is that we're just going to have a bad day in security. Like, we can do everything right all the time, and bad days are just going to happen. And so the question then becomes, you know, what's worse, the mistake or the cover up of the mistake? Like, I think we've all learned that lesson in the past, right? So can I show that I had a problem, but I've gotten better off of it? And that's the type of conversation CISOs are starting to ask to put in front of boards to show, again, forward momentum, forward progress. And that all also rolls back to kind of the reason we got into OSDA. Is we want to be able to track and understand that forward momentum. What was that response and was there an improvement? And that requires more data, which led us right back to, well, we're already loading in a bunch of external data. We already have that external pressure. Am I just going to increase that and cause that problem? Or did we have to figure out another way of capturing that and putting it somewhere so that we can help with answering those questions on what is your most effective tool? How are you judging tool effectiveness? What are your number one concerns that are out there? To go back to your question, like a PCI or a FinServ scenario and the cost of a breach, you may think that you don't have something that is of great value to an organization. And frankly, you may not, but you may have a business relationship with someone who has information that may be looking for. So we've seen a lot of accidental or non-direct breaches that have happened in the past. Targets of opportunity. We've seen a lot of tangential attacks, even going back to the old Target breach, right? Where let's go through an HVAC company to get into Target. Let's don't go to the front door. Let's go through the window type scenarios. So those are the conversations that have to be had and explained at that CISO, at that SOC manager, at that board level perspective of what's our threats? What's our capabilities to defend against those scenarios? What's our exposures? And then can we show forward progress in our security programs?
Love that. We had an image pulled up a bit ago of the DeepWatch paper that you all put out pretty recently. And that was kind of the inspiration behind this show today. What I've always been curious about when I see a white paper or a resource from an organization like DeepWatch is who's the audience? So who should read this white paper here?
A fantastic question. Since I was a bit of an author on a lot of it, none of my family is the answer to that up front. that resource was really kind of written for people in security, right? I'm not going to say it's for SOC managers. It's not for CISOs. It's not for SIM architects or threat hunters or any specific vertical or specialization within security. This idea and this project for OSDA or Open Security Data Architecture is for security, right? Again, we have a lot of data, so we have to organize it. We have to hold ourselves accountable so that we can all be faster. So it's not a use this as the guide as the SOC manager to push this down on or push this up on type of folks. Let's discuss this. Let's start thinking about these things. Because again, the point of all this is reducing the external and internal pressures. And each one of those are going to be unique, right? What does your team look like? What does your shift look like? What does your career progression look like? And what are some of the questions you know you need to answer more quickly to show your value to your organization, to your business, which would allow you to advance? Or, hey, I'm just not getting the information that I really want. There's too much information over here, or we're moving things along there. Start thinking strategically versus reacting tactically is the message of that around this larger architecture that we want to foster and grow.
I think when it comes to this type of arena, you know, we're talking about the future of SIEM and security operations. I do think that a SOC manager or a CISO would be great influencers to direct change for their teams, especially by reading this white paper. You know, if they wanted to, you know, alleviate some of that burnout, they wanted to introduce things like hyper automation and OSDA. What would be your one piece of advice to a SOC manager or a CISO to kind of like start walking that path to improvement?
So again, historical, which is what automation was supposed to do. But the thing I learned very early in my career that's always kind of stuck with me is if you have to do it more than three times, you should automate it. Mm-hmm. Right. Going way, way back. Right. From a testing perspective.
I love that.
Right. So the same thing applies now here. Like if, for example, I'm having to do that phishing request more than three times, or if I'm having to do that IP lookup more than three times, that's absolutely something you should be looking at from an automated perspective. And again, getting back time in the day is how you start reducing the burnout and letting analysts think a little wider and giving them more time. Analysts in tier one, tier two, tier three, that job's not going to go away. We just want to give them more time to think and to be more effective rather than knee-jerk reacting on every alert that comes in. But that same thing applies is once you've said, okay, if I have to do this more than three times, automate it. Great. Save myself some time. Ask standard questions. Build standard playbooks, processes, runbooks, whatever turn of phrase you want to apply to that. But then you got to look the next step past that, which is if I've automated this, but I'm automating it and the same response is happening over and over and over again, then I'm engaging in the definition of insanity, right? I'm having the same action over and over again and expecting a different result. So you have to look at, well, I've automated that password reset 45 times. I've automated that process kill 15 times. What do I need to do from a program perspective to get ahead of that? Is that a training thing? Is that a policy change on my endpoints that would just handle that and I don't have to even spend the computational cycles within automation to make that go away? So we have to not just look at my time from an analyst perspective. Again, that's internal pressure. You have to step back out of that to look externally on why is this continually to happen? Is this a setting? Is this a debug policy from a firewall that's just sending me data that I just keep ignoring? Like, it build some time tactically, internally to get your lay of the land, try to get your feet stable, and then look outward.
Sound advice. That is sound. I would recommend anybody to do that. I mean, that's very methodical and I would say strategic without being caught up in the constant state of reaction. definitely check out Deep Watch. You know, supporting our partners and sponsors is the best way to support the show. So big ups to Deep Watch. Big thank you to the Deep Watch team. And also thank you, Neil. If you haven't already connected with Neil or Deep Watch, be sure to go to the comments section, click on Neil's name, click on Deep Watch, and click follow. And would love to stay in touch. So drop us a message, drop Neil a message. And Neil, again, thank you so much for spending some time with us and our audience. And with that, we will see everyone next time.
Thanks, everybody. Appreciate it.